From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a discussion about manic depression with Kay Redfield Jamison. She's the author of several books on depression, including the leading textbook on the disorder. But what she knew as a clinician didn't make it easier for her to live with the illness. She wrote about her own struggle in the memoir, An Unquiet Mind. Also, actor David Paymer. He played a corrupt game show producer in the film Quiz Show. Now he portrays a movie producer who comes to town in David Mamet's new film, State and Main. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about bluegrass's revered duo, the Stanley Brothers. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Another glimpse of the economic picture this morning as the Labor Department released the latest unemployment figures. They show the jobless rate held steady in December at 4%. Analyst Hugh Johnson says that may cause the Federal Reserve to hold off making any more cuts in interest rates.
I think what they're likely to do is to wait and look at the January employment data that we'll see at the beginning of February and even the February employment data at the beginning of March. And then I think at their March meeting, they'll decide whether they need to go further.
Investors not pleased with the latest figures. The Dow Industrials are down 213 points at this hour. The Nasdaq is down 112. A senior is...
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. 1 in 10 children in the U.S. suffers from some sort of mental illness, but only 20% receive treatment, according to a new report from the U.S. Surgeon General's office. The study identifies depression as one of the most overlooked disorders and calls for an overhaul of children's mental health programs. Manic depression is a disease which often surfaces in late childhood. It distorts moods, can incite dreadful behavior, destroy the basis of rational thought, and erode the desire and will to live. That's how Kay Redfield Jamison describes it in her 1995 book, An Unquiet Mind, a memoir about her own bouts with the extreme mood swings of manic depression. The book is now out in paperback. Jamison is also the author of Night Falls Fast, Understanding Suicide, and Touched by Fire, about writers, composers, and artists living with manic depression. She's a professor of psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Terry spoke with Jamison after the publication of her memoir. Jamison described her symptoms before she started taking medication.
When I was manic, I did everything from spending inordinate amounts of money, like $30,000, $40,000, on things that I had absolutely no use for, things from ranging from snake bite kits to extremely expensive watches to jewelry to things, you know, I think I gave away money. I mean, just completely worthless sorts of spending of money to just going around and, you know, you just do this kind of enthusiastic babbling and trying to convince people of these great ideas and schemes and plans that you have. It's an extravagant state. It's a highly energetic state. It's a contagious state. I mean, one of the things that's, I think, to me, is from a human point of view, the most interesting thing about manic depressive illness is it's so tied to moods, and moods are very, very human sorts of things. And the level of energy just sort of bubbles out and creates kind of a high energy field around the individual who's manic. And up to a point, this can be very seductive and very enticing to other people. After a certain point, it becomes very irritating and obnoxious and exhausting. In depression, I think the thing that you're asking, what was the most extreme thing I did, is certainly the most extreme thing, and the thing that's absolutely most, for myself, completely unthinkable was that I tried to kill myself. I mean, I just can no more imagine wanting to die now when I'm normal. I mean, I'm terrified of death. I don't want to die. I love life. I enjoy life. It's inconceivable to me that I would want to die. And yet when I was depressed, it was inconceivable to me that I would want to continue to live.
How did you reconcile, when you're going through these incredible mood swings, how did you reconcile the highs and the lows and the person you were when you were high with the person you were when you were depressed?
Well, I think it's not, if when you're high and when you're low, you don't try and reconcile much of anything. It's really when you're your normal self that you look at the chaos around you that's become your life and you wonder, where on earth did I go? You know, where am I in all of this? I think it's very hard I was brought up in a very conservative family and a very conservative lifestyle, which I cherished, and I still do cherish. And to look around me at some of the things that I'd done when I was manic and just flamboyantly manic, it's just very hard for me to sort out who was who in there.
You write that at first your illness seemed to be an extension of yourself, of your changeable moods and enthusiasms. When did you realize it was more than that?
Well, I think I had sort of fleeting glimpses of judgment and insight. I think that when I was brought up, in an Air Force family, and as I say, a very conservative family, there weren't really words and labels. I mean, there wasn't, you know, people know the word depression now, and perhaps less so the words manic depression. But at the time I was growing up, these words just weren't used. The concept wasn't there. And I first got ill when I was in high school. I got profoundly depressed, and actually I got quite hypomanic. But to me, it was that there was something wrong, but I didn't think of it as an illness. And even though I went on then to do graduate work in psychology and took courses, clinical coursework and so forth, I still somehow did not attach it to myself. And I think this is a problem that an awful lot of people have. I mean, the major problem with mood disorders is not that they're not treatable, because they are. I mean, depression and manic depression are extremely treatable diseases. The problem is that people don't recognize what they're going through as illnesses. And, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I think that these illnesses are very hard to label as illnesses because they seem tied up with one's personality and moods, and we don't think of that as disease.
Well, as you say in your memoir, manic depression is an illness that is biological in origin, yet it feels psychological.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's, you know, it's a very subtle point. And I think even years after studying mood disorders for a living, as it were, and having it and having the illnesses in my family, I still find it at times difficult to sort out what's just kind of a reaction to life and what's a disease. I mean, I have much more of a sense now. And there's no, it's unequivocally clear to me that what I have is a very bad form of a disease. But for a long time, you know, you can just sort of say, well, maybe this is just me.
When you did start seeking help, you were prescribed lithium, but you fought it for a long time. Why didn't you want to take lithium?
I fought it. I wish I hadn't. You know, I lost a lot of years of my life, and I regret it now, but I think it's something that I probably had to do. I fought it because, I mean, at a somewhat simplistic level, and perhaps the easiest level to understand, but not the most real level. The simplest level was I had very bad side effects. At the time I first started taking lithium, lithium was prescribed at much higher levels than it is now. I'm now on lithium and I have virtually no side effects, but at that time I was on high levels and I found it difficult to read. I had a very rare reaction to lithium in terms of very bad blurring of vision and an impairment in my concentration. I got nauseated. But I think that wasn't the real reason. The real reason was I thought that, you know, I shouldn't have to take a medication. It was not clear to me in my own mind that what I had was a disease because I would feel well again. And I think it's something that you see not only in psychiatric illness, but you see it in, you know, diabetes and chronic heart disease, that once people start feeling better again, it's very hard to stay on chronic medication. I fought like a crazed weasel. I really resisted the idea that I was mentally ill, that I had something that I couldn't just control with will and intellect and personality, that I couldn't just exert sort of enough, you know, energy over it to control it. It's a hard thing to accept.
So you've been on medication for a long time. Do you miss anything about the highs or the lows? Well, the highs, I'd imagine you'd miss, and not the lows.
I don't miss the lows. I do not miss the lows, not for a second.
What about all the energy from the mania, the energy, the self-confidence and enthusiasm?
Well, I think what we miss about the mania is that, well, there's several things. One certainly is the high energy level, but I have a pretty high energy level anyway, and I think I tend to exhaust people around me as is. So I'm not sure that it's energy so much anymore. There's an easy flow of ideas, and there's a wonderful sense of just vitality and just this infectious enthusiasm and, you know, joie de vivre and passion for life. And that's very seductive. It's very hard to give up. There's an intensity, you know, in the same way that I think that love brings a certain kind of intensity into one's life. And war does in a very, very different sort of way. You know, why is it that people remember war experiences, even though they're so awful? It's because I think there's a certain intensity and a certain sense of shared experience, perhaps. So it's hard to give that up, actually.
You recently asked your psychiatrist for a copy of your medical records.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most valuable part or the most surprising part about reading them?
I think it was a very interesting experience. It's not that I forget how bad depression is, but I think in order to go on and in order to survive and live, you have to deny the degree of despair that you experienced. And what I had forgotten was the degree of misery of my depression. And just reading these very cool clinical notes about how suicidal I had been, how awful I felt for week after week, month after month, was not just disturbing, it was very frightening.
Kay Redfield Jamison from a 1995 interview with Terry Gross. Her memoir, An Unquiet Mind, is just out in paperback. More after the break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, we're featuring a 1995 interview with Kay Redfield Jamison, author of An Unquiet Mind, a memoir of manic depression.
I'd like to ask you, if you wouldn't mind, a little bit about your suicide attempt. Would that be okay?
Sure.
How did life look to you at the time that you said, it's not worth it anymore?
Life to me seemed absolutely pointless. Every minute of the day was an exercise in futility and pain. And there seemed to me no reason to go on. It seemed to me that I was incapable of doing my work in the way in which I wanted to do it, and I was incapable of being the kind of friend that I was used to being, and I was incapable of being the kind of family member that I thought I wanted to be. Every aspect of my life seemed a failure, and I wasn't used to failure. I could not stand the pain. It's just a very hard thing to describe. There simply was no point in living.
What method did you decide to use to take your life?
I decided to kill myself with an overdose of lithium because that's what I had available to me, and I thought if I took a drug that would keep me from vomiting it up, which I got a large amount of, I knew that the drug would kill me, and I knew that I was on sort of a quasi-suicide watch from my doctors, and most of my friends were doctors, so that I knew that I was not going to get access to very lethal medications, and that would require a smaller number of pills, so I knew that lithium was the only thing that I could really do.
Well, you'd prepared well for the job. How were you saved?
I was saved by the fact that you can prepare for irrational acts only so well. And I think that I thought that I would have, I would just go off into a coma. It's not one of those things that they teach you. You know, here I was really treating people with the illness, and certainly had experience with other people who had attempted suicide or who had committed suicide, patients, friends, whatever, colleagues. And yet I thought I would just sort of take my medication and fall into a coma. But actually the fact of the matter, and so I took my telephone and I put it many rooms away so I wouldn't answer it. I knew that I couldn't take the phone off the hook, because if I took the phone off the hook and my family or my friends called, they would immediately have somebody over there because they knew I was very depressed. So I just removed the phone to another room. And what happened is my brother was in Paris, and he was calling to see how I was doing. And I was really pretty comatose, quasi-comatose. And I must have crawled on my hands and knees when I heard the phone ringing. And just, you know, however it is that a very drugged brain works. And I picked up the phone, and my voice was very slurred, and my brother called a doctor.
So after you were, you know, back in the world of the living again, what did you change in your life?
Well, I certainly stayed on my medication. I don't suppose I changed a whole lot. I had much more of a deep commitment in my professional life to studying psychosis, to studying suicide, and to studying why people don't take their medications, and to studying the psychological aspects of manic depressive illness as well as the medical side. I mean, I really came out of all of it with an absolute determination to try and do something about the illness, to try and change how it was perceived by society because of the terrible stigma that is attached to it, to try and make a difference, I guess.
You know, in your memoir, you ask the question, are manic depressives an endangered species? You mean because of drugs that can treat the disorder?
Well, less because of drugs than because the fact that the illness is genetic means that at some point in the not-too-distant future, we will have genetic tests where you can tell if a fetus has manic depressive illness, has the gene or genes for manic depressive illness. Society may be able to develop gene therapies that prevent the development of the illness altogether. You may be infected, be able to find out which children are at high risk and pre-medicate them before they ever experience severe mood swings.
Would we be losing anything if manic depression did become extinct?
Well, I think this is an issue that's a very real ethical issue. I think the one side of it is that you will be able to diagnose people earlier and more accurately and treat them and prevent them from having to go through the pain and suffering that manic depressive illness brings along with it, and also develop far more specific treatments that have far fewer, you know, side effects. And that's the good side. The problematic ethical side is actually something we're studying, that looking at that question exactly, what are the ethical aspects of finding gene therapies for an illness that almost certainly confers advantage to society, but not to the individual?
You know, I am not manic depressive, but I do often feel like I'm controlled by moods that seem to have more to do with my internal atmosphere than with anything that's happening externally.
Mm-hmm.
That there's days when I feel like, hey, throw it at me, I can handle it. And other days when just the slightest thing will sink me into this profound depression. And I'm sure it has something to do with whatever chemicals or hormones are coursing through my body at the moment.
Have you ever charted it?
No. Do you recommend that?
Yeah. I mean, if you just do something very simple like the same time every day, because there's a diurnal variation in moods. I mean, you know, so you want to do it at the same time every day. But if you, like at 9 o'clock every night, just rate yourself like +3, -3, on whatever measure you want to use, whether it's energy, enthusiasm, mood, anxiety, whatever. And just chart it out for about 6 months.
And
+3 to -3.
And what will I learn from that?
I bet you will find possibly a 2-week pattern. Possibly a 30-day pattern, but what you will see is probably a definite pattern.
And so if you have figured out the pattern,
mm-hmm.
what do you do with it?
Well, it depends on how strong it is. I mean, like, for example, if you were a clear cyclothymic, which would be like a mild manic depressive, but a very intense version of what you're describing,
mm-hmm.
And say you found out that you were like up 3 days and then down 6 or 7 days and then up 3 days and then down 6 or 7 days. You could tell a whole lot if you did it over the course of a year. One thing is you could check to see if there's seasonal patterns. You could check to see if there are premenstrual patterns. You could check to see if there's anything in your outside life that's contributing to it. But you also can, you know, plan a bit. The very fact of observing gives you some control. You see the pattern, and you can say, okay, you know, basically, if you've got creative work to do, then you just kind of count on the updates. And if you've got periods where you can begin to see what's the beginning of a down period, then you can just do Mickey Mouse work or administrative work or whatever. You know, it depends on what your work consists of. But you can begin to regulate it at some point. Also, you can see, I mean, much more importantly from a mood disorder point of view, whether it's getting worse or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's getting worse over time or as you get older, then you want to just, it's good to have a baseline of that, because then you can say, okay, if I go get treated, is this treatment making me better? Is it making me worse? Is it making me better in the short term but making me worse in the long term? You have some sort of baseline then.
You know, the last time we talked after the publication of your book, Touched by Fire, about artists and writers who were manic depressives, there's almost a little skirmish in the station of people who wanted the copy of your book.
Uh-huh.
So many people had relatives who had manic depression, relatives who had been prescribed lithium but weren't taking it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was causing serious problems for their friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask you a question related to that. For people who have someone who they're close to, who has been prescribed something for a mood disorder and they're not taking it, do you have any recommendation of what might be helpful to do to get the person to take it, especially if they go through these, you know, suicidal periods?
Well, it's a very difficult thing to do. You often see that kind of resistance very early on in the disease. And sometimes just showing people, I mean, this is, I think, is an advantage of going to a clinic that specializes in mood disorders, where people know a lot about the course of manic depressive illness, where they can show people the course of the illness over time, because that actually tends to be a fairly convincing sort of thing. If you actually, because most people just sort of think, well, I can always go back on the medication. But the fact of the matter is that it takes a toll if you don't go back on it, and it does get worse. And seeing the natural course of the illness physically, you know, on charts of how it does, you know, in 1,000 patients or something, sometimes can be helpful. It's a situation where education goes a long way. You know, if people are in the area of a university clinic, you know, teaching hospital that has a specialty clinic, there should be sort of educational programs. Often the support groups, you know, like the advocacy groups, like the National Depressive and Manic Depressive Association, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, have family support groups and patient support groups. And often patients are much better able, for obvious reasons, to get other patients to, you know, in the same way that alcoholics are much more able to get people to realize that they're denying that they have a problem. There's a lot of denial in manic depression. And sometimes just you have to hear it from other people. And one of the reasons why one of my colleagues said, well, Katie, did you have to be so honest about your problems about taking lithium, you know? Because I think he thought that it would be better if I just sort of said that I took lithium and I walked off into the sunset and everything was glorious and my life was just all new again. And I said, but that's not true. You know, it wasn't true for me and it's not true for a lot of people. And one of the reasons why I tried to write as honestly as I could is to say, look, these are the consequences of not taking this medication, you know. I think most people are not aware of the consequences of not taking medication, really, really aware.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Kay Redfield Jamison spoke with Terry Gross in 1995. Jamison is the author of an essay on manic depression in the forthcoming book States of Mind, edited by Robert Conlon. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a conversation with actor David Paymer. He was nominated for an Academy Award for his role in Mr. Saturday Night. His other films include Get Shorty and Quiz Show. He's currently starring in the new film State in Maine. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the 20-year history of the bluegrass duo, the Stanley Brothers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The soundtrack for the Coen Brothers' new movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?, features music from the bluegrass duo Ralph and Carter Stanley. For our rock historian Ed Ward, their work epitomizes what great bluegrass music should be: instrumental virtuosity, clear harmony singing, and highly sentimental lyrics. Today, he looks back on the 20-year history of the Stanley Brothers.
Train 45 leaving Union Station, Cincinnati, Ohio. All aboard for all points south.
A couple of years ago, a small record company asked Bob Dylan if he'd like to contribute to a Ralph Stanley album. Dylan later said it was the greatest honor he'd ever been given. Why? Listen to this.
In constant sorrow all my days, I am in constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days. I've been that way. Kentucky, the state where he was born and raised.
Ralph Stanley and his brother Carter were born in 1927 and 1925, respectively, in Dickinson County, Virginia, where their mother played banjo and their father sang ballads. In church, instruments were forbidden, so the preacher would line out the hymns, singing a line for the congregation to repeat. All of these influences joined together for the boys, and in their early teens, they formed a band with Carter on guitar and Ralph on banjo. World War II put an end to that band, but by 1946, they had a regular job on the radio in Bristol, part of which is in Virginia, part in Tennessee. Within weeks of taking it, they were receiving between 500 and 1,000 letters a day, and before long, a tiny record label, Rich R. Tone, approached them with a contract.
Oh, run, oh, mighty run, oh, mighty run, Timber's gonna beat you like bright shining sun, bright shining sun, oh, Lord, bright shining sun. Timber was a big bay on slow down shaggy mane, he run all around Memphis and he beat the Memphis train, beat the Memphis train, oh, Lord, beat the Memphis train.
The records were poorly recorded, and the band's style hadn't gelled yet. Plus, Rich R. Tone's distribution only covered a small region, but they sold as many records as they could press. In 1948, they signed with Columbia, which already had Bill Monroe on its roster. Monroe warned the label that if the Stanleys came, he'd leave, and he was as good as his word. Columbia, however, wasn't fazed. They thought they'd gotten the best of the bargain, and the Stanleys obliged them by innovating. Ralph began playing banjo in the new three-finger style Earl Scruggs had made popular, and their vocal arrangements were unlike anyone else's.
In the deep rolling hills of old Virginia, there's a place I love so well, where I spend many days of my childhood, in the cabin where we love to dwell. White doves will mourn in sorrow, the willows will hang their heads. I'll live my life in sorrow, since mother
and while other bluegrass bands were mostly playing traditional material, Carter Stanley proved himself the kind of songwriter who could make a new song sound old. He could also write songs which made people want to dance.
I saw you last night in my dreams, love. I woke as the clock was striking four, but I didn't think that I'd meet you. And now as you walk through the door, come sit here with me, little darling, and allow me to say I love you, sweetheart, I love you.
For some reason, the boys quit the music business in 1951 for about a year, returned to make a few more records for Columbia, and then signed with Mercury, an up-and-coming independent label. Many bluegrass fans, and the brothers themselves, consider this five-year period to have produced their finest work.
Thank you.
But there was a problem. As bluegrass was getting better, it was selling less. As the country population gradually urbanized, bluegrass found itself competing against honky-tonk songs and a newcomer called rock and roll. By 1958, the boys were off Mercury and recording for a tiny regional label again, but they were saved when King Records in Cincinnati picked them up. At King, they modernized their repertoire, if not their style.
I'm a-walking from one bar to another. I don't know where I'm going or where I've been. No one I meet realizes I'm trying when I know I can't win.
Actually, that's not totally accurate. In a notorious incident, Sid Nathan, owner of King, had them record a version of a rock and roll hit he'd recently had. They weren't Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, and Finger Poppin' Time disappeared without a trace. So, almost, did the Stanleys. They recorded infrequently, took whatever jobs they could find, and, in December 1965, Carter Stanley died, ending one of the greatest partnerships American music has ever seen. Ralph Stanley continues to tour to this day, and his son, Ralph II, has also started recording. If, as they do in Japan, America awarded living treasure status to its artists, Ralph Stanley would be a prime candidate. As it is, we're reduced to seeking out their hard-to-find records. It's a quest worth taking.
Ed Ward is a writer based in Berlin.
My latest son is taking phase. My race is nearly run. My strongest trials now are past. My triumph has begun. Oh, come, angel band, come and around me stand. Oh, bear me away on your snow-white wings to
coming up, actor David Paymer. He stars in the new film State in Maine. This is Fresh Air. In David Mamet's new comedy, State in Maine, David Paymer plays Marty Rossen, an aggressive movie producer who's on location in a small Vermont town. Among the things he has to contend with is a high-maintenance actress, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, who all of a sudden has second thoughts about doing a nude scene.
Let me tell you something. Wally, he's a pussycat. My thing is to see everybody does what they said they would, and I got to do that. Now, what is this? You want $800,000 to do what you're being paid to? You already signed you'd do? What is that?
I think I should talk to my agent, Marty. You and I should, we should really not...
Who is her agent?
Mitch Cohen.
Get him on the phone.
He's on the island. He'll be back on Tuesday.
Get him on the phone. I want you to hear this.
It's ringing.
I really think that business matters should be discussed between
Well, I'm going to discuss them between you, babe, because it's your idea. And you think you're going to sign to do a job, then hold us up in the wild. Sweetheart, you are in error.
He's on the phone.
Thank you. Mitch, this is Marty Ross, and I'm here in...
Waterford, Vermont.
I'm somewhere in the... I'm on location, eh? Well, I'm going to solve it here, or this bimbo you sent me is going to be doing a donkey act on public access television. We hired her because of 10 years at the actor's studio, the way she played Medea. Her last two pictures lay there on the screen like my first wife.
You have no rights.
Cool it, babe. You started this.
What's the... Where have you been?
No, you tell me. You tell me now. I got a shoot on Wednesday. I will not pay your blood money. And P.S., pal, I put the word out on the street and Betty Boop can look for work in squiggle vision.
Marty Rossin isn't the first showbiz type Paymer has played. He played a TV producer in the film Quiz Show, which is now out on video. Quiz Show is about one of the biggest scandals in TV history, the revelation in 1958 that the game show 21 was rigged. Contestants were sometimes provided with the questions before airtime. Here's a scene from Quiz Show in which Paymer, as producer Dan Enright, tells contestant Herb Stemple, played by John Turturro, that it's time for him to throw the game.
You lose when I tell you to lose.
Oh. It's an arrangement. It's always been an arrangement.
If you told me to lose before, if you told me to lose right from the beginning, then I'd understand. That'd be the story of my life. But why now? What did I do?
Look at the big picture. It's not like television is going to go away, you know? I mean, think about the future.
You mean like a panel show?
Yeah, check.
Now, the last category is movies.
We're going to ask you what won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1955. You don't know it? You answer on the waterfront.
Oh, no. Oh, no, don't do that. Not Marty. I saw Marty 3 times. The best picture from 2 years ago, and I don't know it?
Someone of your intellect, and it's such a simple question. Don't you see the drama of that?
Drama?
Herb, don't do this to yourself.
Please let me lose on a physics question. Not Marty, Dan. Don't do this to me. It's too humiliating.
For 70 grand, Herb, you can afford to be humiliated.
Terry Gross spoke with David Paymer in 1995 when Quiz Show was released. Although game show producer Dan Enright sounds like the villain of the story, actor David Paymer told Terry he didn't play it that way.
You know, Dan Enright, what he was really concerned about was ratings and putting on a dramatic show. And I even watched interviews with him in his later years, and all he would talk about was drama. We wanted drama. And he was really following a long tradition of rigging, or the euphemism, I suppose, was controlling these quiz shows that dated back to the 40s in radio. And, you know, Dan Enright was trying to create a dramatic show, and in a way he thought that he was educating the country. And I sort of took that tack as an actor, that my character felt he was doing a good thing for the country, that he was sort of opening up education and knowledge and intellect for the school children of America. So I really, I played him as a college dean, mm-hmm. not as the bad guy.
Did you ever watch any of the game shows that Dan Enright produced?
Yeah, Robert Redford gave us these kinescopes of the original shows of 21, a lot of the shows that are depicted in the film. And it's quite fascinating to watch these contestants in retrospect. Some of them were very good actors, actually. But then again, some of them, when you watch it now, it's almost laughable. And you wondered, you know, why didn't the American public realize they were being duped? Because they'd ask questions like, what was the name of Paul Revere's horse? And then these contestants would be like, let me think. I mean, a question like that, usually either you know it or you don't. And they're taking all this time and really being dramatic, like Enright told them to. And some of it looks quite fake.
Of course, so much on TV from that period looks fake to us now.
Well, that's true, I guess. And I suppose, well, it's a testament to the power of the medium, of that very new medium at the time, that when people saw it coming over the airwaves, they just believed it, you know?
Though I have to say, you know, like Wheel of Fortune isn't exactly verite. You know, I mean, quiz shows have never looked exactly real.
Right. But I guess it's really the line that Scorsese says in the movie when he says, Scorsese, playing one of the sponsors, says, well, the quiz shows will be back. They're just going to have to ask easier questions because the American people, really, they don't care about the questions or the answers. They're just following the money. And, well, Jeopardy's sometimes difficult, though, isn't it?
Yeah, right. It
at least if you play Double Jeopardy.
No, what did you do to get the look of the era?
Yeah, and what a look. talk about unflattering.
Didn't like those glasses?
Someone said to me after seeing me, gee, Dave, you have absolutely no ego at all. It's so great. I mean, you know, what does that mean? Well, I know what it means. Well, you know, Dan Enright didn't have the greatest hairstyle in the world. And actually, Redford suggested a hairpiece for me, which is really not flattering at all, because it's sort of that bacon strips, you know, combed, you know, brought over from the side, and it looks terrible. And then these dark glasses, sort of like the Steve Allen glasses of the 50s, but really thick, which is what Enright wore back then, too. So I was looking at a lot of pictures of Enright, and, you know, it's not really my... not really my choice of a way to look, but I think it worked for the role.
What was it like to work with Robert Redford as your director? Do you think he has any insights by virtue of having worked as an actor for so many years?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Redford is absolutely an actor's director. And by that I mean he knows how to speak with actors. He knows how to talk with them. He knows how to communicate what it is he needs in a scene. I like to say that Redford knows the actor's secret handshake. He can just say a word or two and make you understand what he's talking about.
What's one of those words he said to you that helped?
Well, for me it was economy. I'm sort of I can be sort of like a nervous guy. A little neurotic, a deal of anxiety here sometimes. And when I started rehearsing Enright, I was sort of moving my hands a lot while I was talking and trying to convince Van Doren, for instance, to go on the show, or the rigged show. And Redford said to me, you know, there's an authority thing, Dave, and it's just economy. It's just not moving around so much in your seat, not using the hands so much. And if you watch my performance, there's a stillness to it that is very different from a lot of the other roles I've played.
Mm-hmm.
And in that stillness comes authority, and it really worked for me. I mean, it's amazing. It's hard to just sit still because you've got all this nervous energy as an actor, but Redford showed me a way to kind of rein that in, and it worked very well for the character.
Actor David Paymer is my guest. The character you played on Mr. Saturday Night, it seems like the opposite side of the coin from the character that you play in Quiz Show. You look similar in terms of like the eyeglasses and everything in both roles. It's the same period. But in Mr. Saturday Night, you're always getting taken advantage of. And in Quiz Show, you're the one taking advantage of others.
Right. Isn't that beautiful?
You know, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, I love when that happens. that's one of the reasons that I was so attracted to the role of Dan Enright, because it was so different. And I think after Mr. Saturday Night, maybe people were thinking, "Gee, that, you know, that David Paymer, he's such a mensch, you know, he's such a nice guy, and I have read for some quote bad guys in the past 2 years, and I haven't got the parts. So I hope that people are seeing the dark side of David Paymer. You know, maybe this will open up a new range for me.
You've told us a little bit about how you carried yourself, that whole economy of motion, in a power role. In Mr. Saturday Night, when you're somebody who's being taken advantage of by your brother, how do you carry yourself differently? How do you use your voice differently?
Well, a lot of Mr. Saturday Night was listening, because... I mean, I learned early on when Billy and I were doing some improvs and stuff in rehearsal that it's pretty hard to top Billy when you're improvising, you know? And I felt a little inadequate in trying to come up with jokes that were as funny as Billy's. And I said that to Billy early on, and he said to me, "That's perfect." And I said, "Why?" He said, "That's how Stan feels." You know, Stan always wants to be as funny as Buddy, and he wants to be in front of the audience, but he doesn't quite have it. So I used that reality in terms of how I felt, not being a stand-up comic, trying to sort of, you know, verbally spar with Billy. And also, I don't know, I just had there was a lot of emotional stuff from my childhood and from my own relationship with my brother that I used in Mr. Saturday Night as well.
Well, you and your brother used to do a comedy act together.
Yes, we did.
What kind of act was it?
not very good.
What else was it like?
Well, it was actually when we first moved to L.A. I'm very close with my brother, Steve. He's a comedy writer. And we used to, he played at Merv Griffin, and I would be Sylvester Stallone, and I would be Nicholson, and we'd do all these impressions. And, you know, we soon found that it wasn't really for us. I mean, being a comedian is kind of like being a salesman, and I don't think I would be a very good salesman, you know, talking people into buying things that they don't really want. I'm not very good at that. And a comedian is like, well, you know, I got these jokes. Do you want to buy them? Do you like them? You don't like them. You're not buying. And it felt like that a lot. So I sort of stuck with acting, and my brother went into writing. I've done some writing as well, but more recently it's been mostly acting for me.
Is your father in show business?
Well, he is, actually. He's a musician, and he also has a doctor of musicology. He went back to school later in life, and but he's a very talented pianist and a composer. And you know, when my brother and I were kids, my parents used to put on shows that they wrote and directed and produced on Long Island, community shows. And I'm from Oceanside, Long Island, and my folks wrote a show called Oceanside USA, and they did it to raise money for the public library and stuff like that. And I can remember when I was 5 or 6 years old sitting in the front row and seeing my dad, like, conducting this little orchestra he put together, and my mom on stage acting. And so, gee, I guess it was in the blood, you know.
Actor David Paymer. We'll continue our interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a 1995 interview with actor David Paymer. He stars in the new movie from David Mamet, State and Main.
You started off in musicals, didn't you, as an actor? I know you were in Grease. I know that was one of your early big breaks.
Yeah, that was really my first break, the show Grease. And I did, you know, I did all the musical comedies back in high school. That was the big thing. I suppose it still is in most high schools.
So did you like Grease?
It was a great experience. It's, you know, it's a fun show, and I was 21 years old, mm-hmm. and I was just out of college, and I walked into an open call, and I got the part, and I did the national touring company, and then they sent me to Broadway within a year, and it was like, it was a dream come true. I mean, that, to this day, that's the most important job I ever got in show business, because I wasn't the type of person or actor who would have stuck it out for like 10 years or 12 years waiting tables. I don't think I had the constitution for that. And I was very lucky to have a measure of success at such a young age.
We know between Grease, Mr. Saturday Night, and Quiz Show, a lot of your roles have been in the 1950s.
I know. It's weird. I mean, I you know, I was reading some of the notices on Quiz Show, and one of them said, you know, and David Paymer, who has, you know, this quintessential 1950s face.
No, what does that mean?
I have no idea. You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm glad because it's worked out.
Have you gone back and looked at family photos from the 50s to see what your family looked like back in the period that you've been playing?
Well, yeah, and I mean, especially my dad, because he, you know, he... Just the hair and that whole look, it just, I don't know, it seems like almost artificial now, but it's, you know, it's that's the way people were. Also, for Enright, there was sort of a... Actually, it gained a little weight for Enright because there was sort of a softness to these guys. You know, these guys weren't working out. They were smoking and drinking, and I don't think they took very good care of themselves. And you can look back at the 50s, and these guys who were relatively young really look kind of puffy. So I was going for that at the time.
I have, in my mind, cast you in two different roles in movie biographies. One is a biopic of George C. Scott, the early years.
Thank you.
And the other is George Mitchell, the early years. I don't know why.
Can I play him when he's baseball commissioner?
Right. But this is in your 1950s guys with those glasses.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, not you as yourself. Actually, I've never seen you as yourself.
You're
in New York and I'm in Philadelphia, so
I have
no idea what you look like out of character.
I look much better than I do on, I'm telling you. I have no ego whatsoever in my film roles. And I don't wear glasses. This is what's killing me.
Not at all? Not even contact lenses?
Killing me. No, I don't wear glasses. And yet, in many of my screen roles, I wear glasses. I don't know. I'm going to have to stop doing that.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I thank you a lot.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
David Paymer stars in the new David Mamet film comedy, State in Maine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Dell Paperbacks Division, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer, with updated listings. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how to lead a horse to jump. We meet David and Karen O'Connor of the U.S. Olympic equestrian team. They're only the second husband and wife to share a medal podium for the same team in the history of the Olympics. In Sydney, they shared a team bronze, and David won an individual gold medal. Join us for Fresh Air.